Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Catherine, Tim, are you there?
I'm here. Hello?
Okay, not hearing y'all. I am going to dial in this way.
Catherine, I'll tell you what, I believe that you and I are on the air, and apparently...
Hey, guys, how y'all doing?
Oh, there he is.
Can you hear us now?
Yeah, I'll tell you what happened. Let me also get the feedback loop going away. I was on the headsets, and the headsets let me through to talk to you on the pre-show, but then as soon as the show started... there goes my access. So I dialed in on my hard line or my phone, and so now got you. And let's get on with this thing. I don't know if y'all pulled the date or anything else, but it's May 12th, 2019. I'm going to skip a little bit of the setup. We are excited today because we have Earl Swift, author of Chesapeake Requiem, one of the finest nonfiction books written in 2018. He's going to come on in about 20 minutes and talk to us about Tangier Island and all about his book and some of the even political, environmental implications and everything else. But guys, let's kind of get into our, bigger topics of the week, some of our national topics. And one of those would be that the Trump administration is just seemingly not following the rule of law. We don't mean just Donald Trump now. We mean pretty much everybody in the administration, and in particular, William Barr. Tim, kind of frame just in the past, week, what are all the things, all the judicial norms that are not being followed?
Well, the entire rule of law basically is being followed. There are three principles, I think, to the rule of law. Number one, no one is above the law. Apparently, that ship sailed with Donald Trump long ago. Presidents should not be able to prosecute opponents or threaten to do it. Now, what were we doing just right before we come on the air? We were talking about, it's broken in the news that Trump has talked to his attorney general about investigating Joe Biden. Now, gee, why do you think he would suddenly want to launch an investigation of Joe Biden? What could possibly prompt that? Plus, we remember the rallies with lock her up, and all such as that. And then there's the respect for an independent judiciary. That went out the window. Trump talks about that Mexican judge or that silly judge or that court that needs to be done away with or that sort of thing every time he gets a ruling against him. In the last week, how the U.S. House has attempted to assert its oversight by, getting the attorney general to come testify. He just refused. They ignore subpoenas. They ignore contempt citations, which are flying now left and right. Steve Mnuchin is stepping in, refusing to release the president's tax returns to heads of committees, which the Ways and Means can ask for it, and the Constitution just says that, and they're even ignoring the very Constitution of the United States. And I don't know where this is going to go. There's this thing about the separation of powers, and we're supposed to have three separate and equal branches, and Trump is just ignoring it. And his entire administration is ignoring it, and of course they're doing that at the urging of Donald Trump himself. He's ignoring the Constitution. They're ignoring contempt resolutions. They're ignoring subpoenas. I don't know where this is going to go, but this gets worse and worse with each passing day, and we really have got ourselves a constitutional crisis, and I frankly don't know how it can be settled.
Yeah, Catherine, it's either that seemingly that Donald Trump doesn't understand the checks and balances of the three branches of government, or just doesn't care, or some combination of thereof, and I'm not sure which is worse. Both are awful if he either doesn't understand a basic tenet of government that we teach students before their 12th grade year, or he's just disregarding it like some type of, dictator from an emerging nation. What do you think?
Well, I think he doesn't understand it. I think he is of the belief that if you're the president, you get to do whatever you want. I think there's, I think that's an idea that people have, that, oh, well, he's the president, he can do whatever he wants, like you said, a complete misunderstanding of the way that the founding fathers, the vision of the way our government was supposed to work. But whatever the reason, I'm with Tim. I don't understand. I don't see how this works out. Like, if he just continues to resist, what do you do? How do you force a hand he's just flat out refuses, and he's got a bunch of people around him that are refusing too. And I don't know, somebody said on this morning, I think it was Schiff, said that they could fine them $25,000 a day while they, don't comply. But who's gonna collect that money, and what good does that do if they're just gonna continue to, not comply? It is a constitutional crisis. What do we do? How do we, because the Republicans are going along with it too. So it's not like we have the Senate and the rest of the Republican Congress to back up the, compliance.
Yeah. Tim, a few weeks ago we had on Jeff Perlman, and we talked about Donald Trump as a sports owner. And so I'm going to frame this in a sports analogy. As incumbent and the holder of the office of presidency, I'm not really sure he owns the arena, but I sure know he does the books. So why is he behaving like he owns both the arena and the ref?
This is the way Donald Trump has behaved his entire life. He has not changed one iota. He has not tried to act presidential in any way. He acts like he wants to act. He has figured out he can do this. He has figured out that he can do this pretty much with impunity. Now that the Mueller report is out, this president feels like he is totally unchained to do whatever. He has finally a compliant attorney general that will go along with whatever he wants to do. He has compliant people all around him now. He has surrounded himself with the type of people he needs. He has the Senate Republicans going along with him, refusing to rein him in any way for political reasons. Either they are afraid to oppose him for fear of a Twitter storm being released on them, or they thinking, well, we're passing stuff we want. We're getting our judges, and we can win another election with him, so we can put up with him, being we can't stop him anyway. And now I believe he also has packed the courts with enough people, especially he thinks that the Supreme Court is his, you know, ace in the hole. So he thinks he can pretty much do anything he wants to, and he thinks that's the type of president this country needs and that he's that guy. And, you know, 46% of the voters go along with him. So, you know, the question remains, who is going to stop this guy? You know, we thought it'd be great when the House went Democratic and they'd have oversight and they could rein him in a little bit. They haven't reined him in very much. They can't.
Yeah, now let's get into that. You know, where do the Democrats go from here? Representative Nadler, they've held William Barr in contempt. My understanding is the House does have police force. They could send somebody to, you know, enforce that and really arrest, not typical arrest like you do for a civil crime out or criminal crime out in public, but they could then bring him into the Capitol because that's where their facility is. And if they brought him to the Capitol, then the thought would be he would then come testify. He might bring an unredacted copy of the Mueller report with him and all these things. Catherine, why is the House leadership not moving ahead, or will they move ahead this week, not any later, and go ahead and send the Capitol Police out for Attorney General Barr?
Well, I mean, they could do that, but what's to say that he would – I mean, he could come along, but what's to say he's going to actually bring the things that we're asking for and then talk about it? I mean,
well,
you can't – I mean, you can drag somebody to, you know, to a some kind of, you know, cell or office or whatever it looks like, but – it doesn't mean they're going to comply.
Well, wouldn't it at least show some force, show some, you know, backbone? I mean, I think that's one problem the Democrats are going to have is if they don't, you know, have any teeth to what they're saying, people are going to lose respect for them. So at least if they brought him in, the visuals would be there. It would seem to a lot of the American public that maybe isn't on board yet, oh, the Trump administration really is violating the rule of law. I just think for nothing else, the
is
optics
what,
they have.
But is that what those optics would say? Or would it say, oh, I'm not saying one way or the other. Or would it say, oh, the Democrats are just, you know, pushing this. Why don't they get back to work and do something, you know, more productive? I'm not agreeing with that. I'm just like, I mean, I would love it. I mean, it would make me happy, but they already have me. So, I'm sure they're balancing, you know, what is going to be, what is going to produce the results that we want. Like, what is going to, you know, get these people to talk and to testify or whatever it is that we want them to do. And what is just going to make Americans more and more frustrated with their elected leadership? I don't know what the answer is.
Tim, I guess I like Catherine playing a devil's advocate there. What's your thoughts on what would be the options of making this move or not making this move?
You know, it's almost as if Trump and them want the Democrats to do something like that so they can scream they're overreaching and how awful it is and how how they need to get back to work and this and that and the other thing. And, I'm not sure how it would play, to be honest with you, even though it would technically be the right thing to do. Something better would be somehow to get Mueller in there to testify. That optic by itself would just be marvelous. And if he said the right thing, then it would give the Democrats cover to begin impeachment hearings. Not actually move to an impeachment yet, but to begin the hearings. And they need to do something. They can't keep saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're threatening to do this, we're threatening to do that, and then do nothing, because that's just going to make Trump and them ignore them more and push against them harder. You got to push back at some point. You got to bloody Donald Trump's nose. It's the only thing he understands when he gets hit right in the nose, like when Nancy Pelosi walked in the White House and just took him apart in front of the country. And then walked out outside putting on those sunglasses. That was a great moment. That sort of thing Trump notices. He's not paying any attention to the Democrats right now. So they're gonna have to make a solid move of some sort. And I think what I would do is try my best to get Mueller in there to testify and start there.
Yeah, I think you're right about getting Mueller to testify, but at some point, and maybe they did those things in reverse, they could have gotten Mueller to testify, then pushed on the report, because they could say, hey, well, look at all this testimony we got. Some of it wasn't even in the report, it was blacked out. And so we need it now. And I guess they could still go back and say that. Tim, you brought up a good point about Nancy Pelosi. She did have a great visual there in that White House meeting. They look tough. Even Chuck Schumer looked tough, and he, of course, gets panned by Saturday Night Live for not being tough on Republicans. Would it be as possible? Could there be something to be, you know, the stonewall everything? And then, you know, we love marches, and we have a march, this, that, and the other, and we'll say, well, kind of what did that march exactly do? What if the House and possibly the Democrats in the Senate marched out of the Capitol straight down Pennsylvania Avenue and just banged on the White House doors? And if Nancy Pelosi was leading that charge, this is not John Q. Public that they'd say, well, you have no access, blah, blah, blah. This is someone that is the closest constitutional equal to the president being the Speaker of the House. I mean, could, you know, would that visual there in a march not be, hey, we mean business and you're not following the rule of law? This is another example of how democracies die. Catherine, what do you think?
Well, that's straight out of West Wing, I'll say, the TV show. That might be a visual that would be appealing. I'm just not sure so they get there, what do they do? What do they say?
They demand to see the president. I mean, just state
right, but that,
thing
so,
one,
so,
and then if they get
so
the TV
they
cameras
to,
there.
He
could
have
get him
out of his robe, get him out of his robe and get him away from Twitter and bring him down to meet them. And then what? I like the visual, but I'm just trying to understand what, like, then what? Like, what's the end result? So they want to see the president. Do they start questioning him?
Yes, they list their 99 grievances, and I'm referencing the Reformation. I mean, they list their, you know, they then say, this is what's not happening. We want to see the report. If you don't think there was any collusion, what are you hiding? You know, they actually, you know, show some toughness. Let's say he says, well, I don't have to see you because I'm the president and I'm a billion times more important than you, because he doesn't understand the Constitution. Then they would have that visual, that they were just stonewalled by the president and he's afraid of something. You know, and then they could go and say, well, look, you know, one of your political heroes, Andrew Jackson, he put the cheese wheel down in the atrium and he would see the regular people. not only you not see the regular people, you won't see the leaders of the country. Although, honestly, he'd probably go rather see the regular people, like that guy in the panhandle that wants to shoot immigrants coming into the country, and Donald Trump just laughed that off this past week. But, I mean, there's got to be more done. I think the Democratic Party looks weak if they don't demand something. Tim, would you agree about the optics of weakness right now?
Well, I wouldn't march down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. That's a violation of protocol. You go to the White House when you're invited to go to the White House. You don't just storm out of the Capitol and head over there, because then you'd look like Trump looks, and you'd be on Trump's level. And if there's we don't want to be on that level. I'll tell you something that would get some of them's attention. You do know that the House does control the purse strings of everything. Well, they ought to quit paying some people. How about that? Quit. If they ain't doing their jobs, then don't pay them till they do. You know, if they're not going to come over there and testify, sorry, we got to cut off your salary, and we're going to divert the money instead to the national debt. Well, the American people love that.
And Tim, we'll get back into that in just a second. Right now, we're welcome our guest to the show, author and journalist Earl Swift. Welcome, Earl.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, and we wanted to have you because of your great new book that came out in 2018, All Kind of Awards, Chesapeake Requiem. I'm going to pass it now to Catherine Smith, one of my co-hosts, and she's going to ask you some initial questions. Then Tim Schiff will ask you some questions, and then I have many, many more. Catherine?
Okay.
Thank you so much for being on the show with us. We really appreciate it.
Catherine.
I have not read your book yet, but our host, David, who was just speaking, has been raving about it for weeks, and so it's on my list, as well as being from Detroit and being a big, you know, car person. I'm interested in reading autobiography as well. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what prompted you to write Chesapeake Requiem? Was there some moment that some epiphany that made you interested in that, or is it just something that's been, you know, bubbling up for a long time?
Well, I'm a former newspaper reporter. I spent 30 years working for newspapers in St. Louis, Anchorage, and for most of the time, 22 years in Norfolk, working for the Virginian Pilot. And while a reporter in Norfolk, I was assigned several times to go to Tangier Island, which is a tiny lump of mud, about a square mile in size, out in the middle of the widest part of the Chesapeake Bay. The bay is about 30 miles wide at that point, and Tangier is in Virginia. It's just south of the state line, and it is 16 open water miles from the nearest Virginia port. So it is, oddly, although it's less than 100 miles from Washington, D.C., it is one of the most isolated communities in the East, certainly, and probably in the lower 48, and has, in its isolation, developed some quirks that kind of set it apart. It had, its people speak a variation of the Tidewater hoi-toid accent that stretches it in ways that no other place really does, to the point where if you were to listen to two Tangiermen speaking with themselves, you know, to each other, you'd be hard pressed to understand 2 out of 10 words that they said. And it's also a practical theocracy of old school Methodism. And when I say old school, I mean unlike any Methodism that's practiced today on the mainland. It's kind of a Civil War era Methodism trapped in amber, pretty much. And we're talking shouting Methodist, you know, the old style layperson directed Methodism. It's a town that earns its living almost completely from the water. You know, the water around it is teems with fish and crab and oyster. And for 240 years, Tangierman have culled the bay of its bounty, and that's really what's put them on the map outside of the bay. If you eat soft-shell crab, odds are it came from Tangier Island. And I guess the last kind of quirk that they share is that virtually every man, woman, and child is descended from the same guy, a guy named Joseph Crockett, who showed up on the island in 1778.
Wow, that's amazing. So there's very little very little immigration to Tangier Island, apparently. And
well,
what's the population?
There's little to do if you got there, except, you know, if you want to be a waterman, if you want to go crabbing, then there's no place better. But there are very few people who aren't born into the waterman's life who choose to follow it. It's a tough way to make a living. Tough and dangerous, and the hours could not be worse. You know, you're up at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, and out on the water hours before sunup. And, you're in a small wooden boat on a big bay that can become tempestuous in no time at all. I mean, the bay is a shallow body of water. It averages 21 feet deep. But that works against you when it comes to wave building. Tangier has a lot of what mariners call fetch, which is room around it for waves to build. And the winds tend to be from the directions where there's a lot of water. And it can go from slick cam, or glassy, as the Tangiermen say, to 5-foot seas in a matter of minutes. And it's, let me tell you, being on one of those little boats when you're in rough water is, it's white knuckle. So anyway, that.
And what's the population?
All that.
What's the population?
460. And falling.
I'm sure.
Anyway, I've been to Tangier several times as a reporter, and then went back for the first time in 15 years in 2015 and stepped onto an island that looked completely different. The effects of sea level rise were obvious wherever I looked. Not only was the bay coming up around over the edges of the island, but at high tide, it came straight up percolating through the ground to make ponds of people's yards. And, you know, the island is dissolving underfoot. And this is a town that's been there since 1778. It's an old, old place. And it is looking now that as if it's a good candidate to be the first real town in America that will have to be abandoned due to climate change.
Okay, that's great. Thank you for that intro. And now I'm going to pass it to Tim. He has a series of questions, and then we'll go back to David. And if we have time, we might get back to me again. Thank you so much again for being with us tonight. And thank you for writing the book.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mr. Swift, for being with us tonight. I'd read that many of the islanders there do not subscribe to climate change. Why not when they see the evidence of it firsthand?
Well, it's a complicated question and there are complicated answers to it, but part of it lies in faith. You know, as I mentioned to Catherine, this is a near theocracy of old school Methodists, and I think that there is a feeling among them that man is too puny to alter the works of God, that the Earth's climate is divinely created and beyond the reach of man to affect. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is that islands have been disappearing in the Chesapeake since the early 19th century, certainly, and probably a lot longer than that. And so they point to that and say, look, you know, this isn't climate change. This is wind-driven erosion. This is, you know, this the result of wave action. And in fact, much of the damage to Tangier is the result of wave action. But what Tangiermen don't grasp, I guess, is that erosion and sea level rise are not mutually exclusive. They are, in fact, inextricably linked, and that as the reason erosion has increased in ferocity over the years is because the seas have come up, and they've been coming up for a long time. You know, we tend to view climate change as a recent phenomenon, but it's been underway for a long time. We just haven't really recognized it. If you go back through the tidal records in the Chesapeake Bay, you'll see that erosion and land loss occurred, but at a very low rate up until about the mid-19th century. About 1850, something happened. There's a point of inflection at which land loss began to accelerate, and it accelerated all through the 19th century, rose to a gallop in the 20th, and now is just moving along at breakneck speed. So if you were to chart sea level rise, it does not follow a straight line on a graph. It is not a steady progression. It is an accelerating progression. So the curve that it creates on a graph is parabolic. You know, it increases in angle as it goes. And what we see now is a group of people on Tangier who for a variety of reasons, but namely those two I mentioned, just don't choose to recognize that what is going on is this climate change that the wider world is wringing its hands about.
Mm-hmm. But having been there several times, having done stories on it, having actually lived there while you were researching this book, do you consider Tangier Island to be a microcosm of the greater climate science debate, with the doubters on one side and those, you know, saying this is what is happening on the other side, and the people in the middle trying to grasp it all? Would you say it's a microcosm of what's going on in the climate science debate around the country?
No, I really wouldn't, because I don't think there's much debate. I mean, Tangier is an extreme case. I mean, the debate's over. You know, I think most people recognize that at this point. There's no debate in the scientific community. I mean, we're talking about a minuscule minority of scientists who are out of step on this question. It's decided.
Unfortunately, though, we have a major political party in this country on the on one side of the debate. We have a lot of very powerful business interests on one side of this debate, albeit for their own reasons. And it kind of makes you say, well, yeah, we're still certainly in a debate, because really nothing's done about it.
Agreed. It's not a scientific debate, though. The science is well established at this point.
Well, people choose
to disbelieve the science. That's, you know,
uh-huh.
Whatever.
Yeah, let's ask you point blank, since you've been there, since you've seen it progress, can Tangier Island still be saved?
It would require heroic intervention, and I mean heroic.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of intervention that could only be undertaken by the federal government, really. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars kind of intervention. But yes, I mean, technically it could be, sure. There is the engineering available to save it if the American people chose to pursue that. And you know, the Tangier's dilemma really, it's important, I think, in that it forces us to a reckoning as a country. And we've got a real town here that is going to, you know, it's got maybe 20 years.
Wow.
And, you know, that it forces us to make a decision as to what we value. What is worth it? It's pretty clear. We've got 88,000 miles of shoreline in the United States, much of which will be imperiled over the next couple of generations. It's pretty clear that we don't have the time, we don't have the money, and we don't have the technical means to save every town like Tangier that's going to be imperiled. So we've got to make a hard decision, a series of hard decisions as to what we save and what we surrender. And that will require us to develop a rubric for making that decision. And Tangier's importance, I think, is less that it's a truly unique blip on the map, and more that it is the first town that is going to force us to really come to terms with the with assigning a value to places and people. And you know, this is it's just the first of hundreds, if not thousands, of communities that will face this dilemma. So, you know, what we choose to do or not do in Tangier's case will inform what we do the next time and the time after that and the time after that. We have to be consistent, it seems to me, if we're going to be at all fair in how we go about this. So we have to figure out, okay, what is it that will decide what communities are worth saving to us? Is it simply a matter of headcount? Is it strictly a you know population? If so, then we are going to willingly give up places, a lot of places that we consider sacred ground as a country or that we consider key to the American cultural tapestry. And, you know, if we consider those sort of cultural components in developing this rubric, well, you know, what values do we assign to what kind of culture? I mean, it's going to get really ugly, and it's going to require people far smarter than me to figure it out.
What I worry about is what is happening a few miles away in Washington, D.C., and I worry that the way things stand that we can't reach a consensus on anything in this country right now, and it deprives us of the political courage to make the tough decisions. Do you worry that the country will not have the political courage to face what's going on in places like Tangier Island?
No, of course. Sure. I mean, you know, the dilemma that we face, that every place faces, is going to require engineering solutions and unity of purpose to a degree that we've never been called upon to demonstrate. And it's going to cost an enormous amount of money. It's going to create a lot of jobs, but it's going to cost an enormous amount of money. And, you know, if we choose not to make those tough decisions, nature's going to make them for us. So, I mean, it's not like if you know, this has got to go away if we choose to ignore it. It's happening, whether we like it or not. And it's going to happen a lot sooner than people realize. We've become complacent, I think, because so many scientific predictions are based on the year 2100. Well,
yeah.
Believe me, this is going to be happening way sooner.
The yeah,
Chesapeake Bay
that,
is
that's a great point that you just made, Mr. Swift, that climate change is a thing and it doesn't care if people believe that it's happening or not. And with that, I am going to send it over to David to ask some more questions. David?
Yes, well, they hit on so many good things, but I'm going to go a little deeper on a few things. And I'll start off since we're talking about the environment and climate change. On Tangier Island, the fishermen and the other residents of the island, they point to erosion as being the problem instead of rising sea levels. Now, it's probably there is some erosion, and rising sea levels could cause greater erosion. But why do they hang on to this erosion is the almost sole cause of what they see is their island shrinking?
Well, as I mentioned to Catherine, you know, a big piece of it is that this erosion has been underway for a long, long time, and people have only recently attached the label climate change to it. You know, when I first went to Tangier in 1999, Tangiermen were already in a low-grade panic about land loss on their island. I mean, Tangier at that point had lost two-thirds of its land since the Civil War. And this is a place that didn't have a lot of real estate to begin with. And so, you know, I mean, they look out their windows. They saw waves rolling in on the west side of the island, and they saw pieces of the west side of the island break off and float away. And it seemed pretty evident to them, well, you know, these waves are the cause of what's happening. Of course, we're beginning to see now that those waves are a symptom of what's happening, that they are part of a bigger system of things happening. And that as the bay rises, and there's no question it's coming up at an ever faster rate, those waves are going to be a lot more destructive. You know, Tangier used to have beach all around it. There's very little beach left now. It's all in a spit at the south end of the island. And the reason is that, you know, the bay has come up and it's carried that beach away. And now water comes rolling in and smacking right into wetlands and drowning wetlands, turning it to mud flat and then to open water. And so you see not only wave action increasing, but you see land loss accelerating. Everything is happening much faster than it used to. And Tangier's always had an erosion problem. It's just that now, over the past 150 years, as the bay has increased in depth, as that water level has come up, that erosion problem is far fiercer than the Tangierman's forebears could have imagined. It'll spell the end of the place, you know, in very little time.
Yes, and I guess the beach is eroding. I'm sorry, the beach is, you know, shrinking to such levels. It's also going to affect the tourism industry, which is a small piece of their economic puzzle. I wanted to ask you, and I'm going to get wording wrong.
Just nobody goes to Tangier for the beach. This is not a tourist destination for beachgoers. It's a tourist destination for people interested in the very quirky culture that they have on Tangier, a product of its isolation for the last 240 years. But this isn't a place with resort hotels or, for one thing, it's a dry island. You can't buy alcohol on Tangier, which limits its promise as a beach destination. For another, it's patrolled by vicious biting flies that rise from the wetlands like mist. And you know, this is a place with a lot of wetlands. 80% of Tangier is salt marsh that floods twice a day. You know, if you've been around salt marsh, you know that it gives a gassy stink off at low tide. So there are many factors of life on Tangier that I happen to love, but that your typical tourist might find unattractive.
Yes, and we've had somebody talk about vacation spots before in the context of politics, believe it or not. So that's more information for our listeners to know that this is more of a vacation, kind of, I guess, like going to Amish country. I'm going to try to recollect an environmental statistic or piece of information that I had never heard outside of your book, but it was absolutely fascinating. And if I get it wrong, please correct me / amend what I say. But in there, you said that people that study climate and Earth's geography said if we did not have the rising temperatures on our planet, that our ocean level in the natural ebb and flow would actually be lower than in previous generations or than it naturally would be. But because of the rising temperatures, now our seas are higher. What exactly was that statistic exactly about? Overall
paper.
Sea level.
You're in the ballpark. It was a paper that came out a couple years ago that showed that had climate change not been underway, had had man-made climate change not been a factor in the Earth's changing weather patterns, temperature, etc., that sea levels during the 20th century would have probably stayed the same, or possibly, although it was a long shot, possibly even dropped a little, but that as it was, with the effects of man's hand on the environment, sea levels came up by about half a foot.
Yes, I just thought that was fascinating, and that really kind of shows the greater impact that humankind has put on our world. But I wanted to ask you another question more about the people, and that would be, as I got to listen to your book more and more deeper into it, it seemed like they were more like really, really devout Mormons that are kind of an insular community, or I just mentioned the Amish. Now, they do believe in technology, so that's a little bit different. But do you think there's, even though there's Methodists, which seems like just a pretty run-of-the-mill Protestant group, do you see the similarities to a more fundamentalist Mormon sect or the Amish even?
Well, you know, I tend to think that, you know, Tangier was not settled, unlike the Mormon, you know, unlike Salt Lake City. Tangier was not settled by Methodists. It was settled by fishermen who embraced Methodism later, after the place had already established a foothold. Unlike the Amish, they do not choose to set themselves apart from American culture at large. It's just that they're physically removed from it. You know, it takes, this is a place that, you know, if you have to go to the emergency room, it's 30 miles away by state police helicopter. So, I mean, they are really kind of way out there. They're out in the middle of 18 trillion gallons of water. That's what really sets them apart. And their Methodism is, I think, an answer to the challenges that they face just living on an island surrounded by so much rough water. You know, if you were called upon to take your life in your hands on a regular basis just to go in to get groceries, you know, to the mainland, you tend to have a different relationship with faith than most of us do, I think. And Tangiermen are big believers in the power of prayer and collective prayer. They have, over the course of the last 240 years, watched hurricanes trundle up the bay right towards them only to veer away, and they believe that their prayer has been the cause of that salvation, that sparing. They have seen diseases, epidemics of disease, lay the community low without dealing it a death blow. And again, they credit their prayer for saving the community at those tough times. And, you know, they've seen fisheries collapse only to rebound a year or two later. Time and time again, Tangiermen have seen or have come to believe that their power of prayer has saved them, and therefore they believe themselves to be an anointed people, anointed by their power of prayer, protected. And really, if you want to look for a big reason why they are unconcerned, not really unconcerned, but unswayed by talk of climate change and about their untenable position because of it, part of it is that they believe they're going to be saved once again. They believe that their anointing will see them through, that there will be a divine intervention to spare them. And that's powerful stuff, more powerful so far than scientists have been able to, you know, to talk around.
Yes, and I had one final question, and it's even more specific about the people. While you were living on the island and going out on the fishing boats and going to all their meetings, you could tell you formed a personal bond with a lot of the main folks in the story, the mayor's father-in-law, Leon. Let me say, if you were a fiction writer and you created that character, your editor would have said, get rid of him or change him because he's just not believable, an 80-year-old man doing all that work. But at the same time, they had all these – go ahead.
87.
87. I think he was 80 maybe the first time you met him. And, yeah, just – of course, time moves on for all of us. But you had this personal connection with all these folks. But yet, when it came to talking about the election and then, of course, the environmental issues, you didn't agree with the folks. How did you kind of at times reconcile – that you liked the people on a personal level, but you didn't agree with some of their political or scientific beliefs?
Well, I mean, David, when it gets down to it, who cares what I believe? I'm there to tell their story, not tell mine. And so, you know, yeah, sure, I had to bite my tongue a few times, but you're right. I came to love the Tangerman. I think they're completely wrong on the question of climate change, but that doesn't affect the fact that I find them admirable and wonderful people. And, you know, I was there to tell their story, and I had to get out. I had to get the heck out of the way. My role in the book, I tend to be a character in my own books, but I'm pretty much, I occupy the same role in each of them, which is that I'm the faceless narrator. I'm the guy who takes you by the hand. I'm your surrogate as the reader. And, I take you places that you can't go by yourself and explain what it is that we're looking at when we're looking at it. That role requires that I keep my mouth shut because the reader is not along for the ride to hear what I happen to think. You know, and throughout the book, I point out that, you know, what the scientific supermajority believes to be happening with the climate. And I point, you know, I the science in the book is based on a great deal of research done by scientists who have been at this for a long time and have very convincing evidence as to what's happening. And it's just up to me, you know, it's my role as I see it to point out when Tangerman are kind of missing the boat on the facts. By letting the facts speak for themselves. I present the facts, but I don't argue with the Islanders. I mean, that's not my role.
Yes, and that's probably the best role to play because you're going to get much more of an openness from them and a much better story. And speaking of that wonderful story, then your book has won so many awards. Seems like you're going to follow it up with a great new project if you're at the point where you can tell folks about your next item you're working on, your next article, book, whatever. Feel free to do that now.
Nope, can't do it.
Can't do it, that's fine.
It's a little too early in the process to jinx it by talking about it now. But I've got a couple of things in the works and hope to be able to do both of them in pretty quick order. But going back just for a second, you know, to your comment after we talked on that last question. Now, this isn't just a strategy to get them to open up to me. I want to make that clear that the decision, you know, that this is their story that I'm telling and not my own. To go in with another idea in your head would be to be practicing something other than journalism, I think. I think that you can present a point of view as narrator, but opinions are pretty out of place. You're there to capture what it is that your subject presents you, and to set the record straight, to verify or refute what that person says, certainly, this is not a strategy. I don't want you or your listeners to think this is a strategy founded in a desire to be accepted more by the people there. This is a strategy that is intrinsic to good storytelling, it seems to me. And my strategy for being accepted by the people there was just to live there for 14 months until they finally got so used to me. And you know, I became part of the wallpaper. You know, and I went out crabbing with them. And I went to church.
Yeah. Quick guessing.
What has been the reaction from the people of Tangiers to the book? Have they enjoyed or are they satisfied with the story that you told?
Well, let me give a kind of a longish answer to that short question. And Tangiers is a pretty media savvy place. It's been visited by big city reporters since the 1890s, certainly, and probably before that. And I mean, the New York Times has a thing about Tangier. They go there every few years like clockwork. And so they're accustomed to seeing reporters, and they're accustomed to seeing reporters do the same thing over and over, which is to show up, maybe spend one night, maybe two, in very unusual circumstances. Talk to a half dozen people, maybe go out with a crabber in his boat for the day, and then leave. And over time, you know, everybody on an island has a role to play. Accountability is impossible to avoid. And over time, a half dozen or so people on the island have become the de facto people who will talk to reporters. They're the ones kind of assigned by the community to take on that job. And so the reporters talk to the same half dozen people over and over again.
No.
And they wind up with essentially a very similar story. Now, one thing that reporters rarely do is go to church, which you have to do. It's a near theocracy. You cannot understand Tangier if you don't go to church. And the other reason to go is that during prayer requests, you find out what's going on with everybody. You find out who's sick, who's had an accident, who's got visitors coming in, who's going off the island, you know, on a trip. You find out everything. It's like getting a daily paper to go to church and listen to the prayer requests. So it's, you know, I came to see it as a pretty essential element of life there, and it demanded my attendance. Now, because Tangiermen have become so accustomed to reading the same story about themselves over and over, I realized that I had to set myself apart from every other reporter when I first got there. And of course, one of the ways I did it was I moved into an actual house rather than staying at one of the B&Bs or whatever. And I went to church, which they were not accustomed to seeing. And I hung out with the old timers at a daily coffee klatch that they have. They call the situation room. And I'm not accustomed to that either. And so I think they had pretty high hopes that what I wrote about them would at least get beyond the same old that they were used to reading. But as you know, David, it's not, I mean, it's a pretty unblinking view of them. It's not an entirely, I mean, they're people with foibles, and I go through their foibles in some detail. And so, you know, my daughter was quite worried when the book came out last August. I decided Tangier was going to be my first reading on the island. It seemed only fair and proper. She was worried that my reading was going to end like The Wicker Man, and because she had read the book and knew that I had gone into detail about their foibles. But I went there with my fiance, and we packed the school auditorium, and we got to the question and answer period at the end of the reading, and I thought, okay, you know, this is the moment of truth. I'm going to either get an earful or I'll find out how the book's going over right now. This is 4 days after the book came out, and by this time, I'm betting half the island had read it cover to cover. And islander after islander stood up, and instead of asking questions, they offered testimony. It was like being in church. They offered testimony about me, about the book, about my fiance, who came to visit me several times while I was reporting the book.
Wow.
And what the sum of all this was that they were just grateful that someone had presented the Tangier that they know, that you know, warts and all. And they would have preferred that some of those warts were left unexplored, certainly. but I, you know, I described the island and life on the island as they knew it to be. And they were just grateful, I think, that that the story, despite it got, you know, it's getting into some pretty embarrassing territory, got it right.
Well, that must have been a great moment for you.
It
I
was
mean, all the,
electrifying.
All the reports was, and the reviews and the awards, but to have told a story and be embraced by the people you told the story about is probably the greatest, I would think. If I was a writer, that would be what I would think would be the greatest reward.
Well, had I just put a shine on everything and you know, made it a nothing but happy story, I wouldn't have felt so great about it. But the fact that, you know, it was a warts and all presentation and they reacted the way they did was one of the most amazing nights of my life. It was an electrifying moment. There were tears. I mean, it was incredible.
Well, congratulations for that.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for telling their story.
Oh, well, it was, you know, I'm an incredibly lucky guy to have been allowed to tell the story, really, because they could have made it tough. They could have chosen not to participate, and they made me a Tangierman for 14 months, which is something that that will stay with me.
Yes. Well, Earl, I tell you what, I guess his name escapes me. The historian from the 1800s that you used a lot of his source material, and of course, I think even had to re-examine some of it. I guess your book
Sugar
is
Tom
right
Tom.
There with his history. Sugar Tom?
Sugar Tom.
So I guess, can you be Sugar Earl now, or have they not hold you that high?
Well, Islanders are still not real happy about Sugar Tom's book. So, I mean, you know, it's a bizarre book because the first half is what passes for a history, although it's, you know, 80% all wrong. And then the second half is this Tom Sawyer-esque kind of memoir of Sugar Tom's youth in the mid-19th century on the island. He wrote it, it was published in 1891. And the Islanders were so scandalized by the Tom Sawyer part of the book that they collected and burned every copy they could get their hands on. So for you know, 100 years, it was really an accomplishment to run across a copy of Sugar Tom's book. There were just none to be found. I had a librarian on the Eastern Shore slip me a photocopy of the library's copy, which they could not keep on the shelves, because had they put it on the shelves, it would have disappeared and would have wound up burned probably. So Sugar Tom's not a his account is not universally embraced on Tangier.
Well, that's good to know. I just remember that Sugar Tom and all the different times you referenced it, particularly early in the book. Well, I'm gonna take another angle on an earlier question to close it out. I understand you can't talk about your next book. If you have any social media sources or anywhere you just write articles more recently, you want to share that with our listeners so they can read you in the interim until your next volume comes out.
Sure. Well, I mean, I write for Outside Magazine, and they can go to the Outside Magazine website, or they can go to my website, which is earlswift.com, and in the news and events page of my website, there's I'll usually post magazine pieces as they come out. I actually have to get on the stick and post my most recent one, but I'll do that in the next couple of days. And, you know, other than that, I don't write for online much. I've got a couple of book projects that should keep me pretty busy for the next year or so. And don't anticipate that I'll be doing a lot of writing outside of that. But, you know, I've got 6 other books. And if readers want to catch up on reading me, they've got plenty of, you know, they've got a 500,000 words they can dig into.
Yes, well, it sounds like Catherine's inspired us to possibly read the Detroit Auto Book. And if so, if we can all get on our little book club and do that, maybe we can have you back in the future and discuss that book and then whatever else is happening in your world.
Sure. I'll be happy to. And it's not a Detroit book. It's the conceit of autobiography is that I found a 57 Chevy wagon and I managed to trace its ownership record back through 14 owners to the day it rolled out of the showroom.
Wow.
And I tell the story of basically of post-war America through this one car and these otherwise disconnected people who happen to share it. And, you know, it centers on one character, the 13th owner, who is the main driver of the thing. He's a bit of a maniac who's been arrested 70-odd times and who buys the car intending to restore it. And that's how the book opens. The car is a complete beater when the book opens. And so the dramatic tension is he going to be able to finish this restoration before all of his various personal and legal demons come home to roost? And he's got a lot of both.
All right. So maybe our listeners now will be on board and they can read or hear that book soon as well. Well, Earl, we want to thank you for coming on the show tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Yes. And listeners, that was Earl Swift, author of many books. The one we discussed tonight, Chesapeake Requiem, just released in 2018. And, I mean, what a list of awards it's won. I thoroughly enjoyed listening to it. I did much yard work very happily this spring break, because I was listening to that book. Well, guys, it's a little after 8 o'clock, so until next week, that's been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night.
Good night, y'all.
All right.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?